Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a conversation between Laura Caldwell, a law professor at the Loyola University Chicago School of Law, and founder and director of Loyola's Life After Innocence, and Christine Bunch, a woman who spent 17 years in prison for a crime she did not commit. In a program titled Life After Innocence, they will talk about what happens next in the lives of wrongfully convicted and imprisoned people. This program, co-sponsored by the Nebraska Innocence Project, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 30th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Barbara Harris, Director of the Social Work Program in the Department of Cultural and Social Studies at Creighton University.
So the mantra for social work this year is, when you do it right, social work is a feeling that is bigger than yourself. Tonight, for the social work program, doing it right was bringing Laura Caldwell and Christine Bunch to Creighton University. Laura is an award-winning author, a lawyer, a distinguished scholar, and director of the Life After Innocence Project at Loyola Chicago. With her tonight is Christine Bunch, a woman, a mother who was exonerated after 16 years in prison, accused of killing her son. And we have a special guest today who I had the just great delight to meet at lunch, and that's Joanne Taylor. Joanne is our Nebraska exoneree from the Beatrice Six, who spent 19 years, wait, she gave me 19 years, 7 months, and 26 days in the York Correctional Facility and was exonerated in 2008. But I really want to thank Jane Rogers. I met Jane Rogers when we were on the board of the WCA. I have begun to understand the force that is Jane Rogers. As a philanthropist, consummate board member, and a great smart girlfriend, she said, you need to meet Laura Caldwell and Christine Bunch, and then she made it happen. And because of her, she thought the issue of innocence was so important to Omaha, she generously funded this event. Exonerations are now common. According to the Innocence Project research, it's estimated that about 2 to 5% of people in prison were wrongfully convicted. If that number is even low and it were 1%, that would mean there'd be about 20,000 people in this country spending time in a prison for crime they did not commit. So I want to welcome Laura Caldwell, the author of 15 books, but the one who brought her to the issue of innocence is The Long Way Home, a man lost in the system and the two women who found him. This is a story about Jovan Mosley. There are many accolades for Laura Caldwell and her writing. Publishers Weekly said Laura Caldwell eloquently evokes Mosley's struggle to have faith in a justice system that had so obviously failed him. But today, I get to spend time with Laura and Christine. And the thing I can say the most about the two of them is that really when you see them together, this is about an act of humanity. And watching them be together in this community, the time we spent today is so remarkable, and I'm so glad that I get to introduce you to Laura Caldwell and Christine Bunch.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. How's my sound? Can you guys hear me up there? Great. I'm going to introduce Christine Bunch to you guys because I don't really think it's fair that we walk out at the same time because she is one of my celebrities. I used to read People magazine, you know, like mostly at the manicure place, and you know, sometimes like during lunch I'd go out to lunch in the law school and we're in Water Tower and I'd go sort of find a spot for lunch and get People magazine and come back and kind of like hang out in my office. But that was before I started representing people who were innocent. And now that I represent innocent people after they get out in order to help them start their lives over. People like Christine. These are my celebrities now. Like, literally, these people who have gone through such amazing hardships, such incredible experiences, with the twists and turns that you really... I've written 14 novels, and most of my editors would never let me include the crazy amount of detail that you see in every case, including Christine's. I did come to After Innocence by way of writing a novel. I had been working as a lawyer. I was a civil litigator. I defended doctors who were sued. So I defended neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons and anesthesiologists, and I became a partner, and that's what you want in the law. You know, it's sort of a common goal. So I was a partner at a law firm, and I was also writing novels. And I finally decided I'm leaving the law. I am just going to write novels. And it was it actually, after a long while, it worked out for me. I sold 7 books within 18 months. So I wrote for 10 years and couldn't sell a thing. Nobody wanted it, couldn't get an agent, couldn't get a publisher. And then finally met the right person and got an agent and got a publisher. And within 18 months, I'd sold 7 novels, 4 mysteries, and 3 romantic comedies. So I literally left the law behind. I come from a family where our law firm in Woodstock, Illinois, turned 100 years old last year, so the law is deeply entrenched in my bones. But I had entirely intended to leave it behind and write novels. I got to writing my 4th novel called The Rome Affair, about a girlfriend's trip to Italy that leads to blackmail and murder. And I do it all good authors do. When you have a research question, you reach out to someone who knows, because even if it doesn't make it in the book, you need the authority as an author. So I was writing about a couple who was charged with murder, and they had this husband and this wife down the hall from each other. And the cops are, and I'm entirely making this up, right? I'm like channeling Law and Order. And so I have like the cops going down the hallway to the woman and being like, hey, you know what your husband is saying? He's saying you pushed your friend over the balcony. And then, chicka-chicka-chicka. And then the cops are down here. And meanwhile, I had no idea what I was talking about. I had represented physicians for a living. So it's just very lazy as an author. You really got to look up these facts. Even if your editor cuts that whole section, I feel like you have to have the authority as an author. So I made a phone call to a woman named Kathy O'Daniel, who's a criminal defense lawyer. And I said, does anyone ever get forced to confess to a crime they didn't commit? And she said, oh, honey, all the time. And she told me about Jovan Mosley, who Barb mentioned. Jovan Mosley was the first in his family to graduate from high school. He was accepted to Ohio State. He was going to be the first kid in his family to go to college. And he went walking around on an August day, and a fight broke out. He wasn't in the fight, but some people had been, some cops pretty much decided he must have been, because he had been around the fight, so he must have been part of the fight. So they put him in a wall. Do this for me, you guys. Can you sit up for a second so you're not leaning? Thank you. So, you know, you're right on the edge of your seat. Now, I think it was the left arm. Lift your left arm. Now move it back and pretend you got a cuff here, and it's cuffed to a wall. Now, I realize this is annoying, but stay with me for a second. So just sit here. Now, this is already annoying. You're already like, I hate when speakers do demonstrative things. It's so silly. But now we're still here. Now, we've been here not even 20 seconds. So imagine 2 hours from now if you're still here. Now imagine this is interrogation lighting. Now imagine you have no food, no water, no sleep. Stay with me. We haven't even hit 30 seconds. Now imagine you're here for 2 days. 2 days. Okay, you can drop it. So if someone came to you and said, you can get out of here, and it's been 2 days, would you or would you not consider it? Writing, just signing something, just so you can get out so you can explain yourself. That's what happens. That is pretty, what I learned, pretty standard. So this woman had taken on Jovan's case and decided this was going to be her first pro bono case. I ended up helping her on it. It was the case that pulled me out of the law. And after we represented him, I found out that, okay, here's a gentleman who's innocent. It was a 10-day crazy trial, and this man has no assistance. So we started Life After Innocence at Loyola just as a class project. I know you guys are working on a lot of things here with social work, and you're working on people who've suffered traumas, are suffering traumas, and that's kind of what we decided to focus on, is people who are innocent in jail after they get out to try to help them start their lives over. Because as we're going to learn, the state, all states, no one provides anything to the innocent. Now they're starting to. Now Texas is actually a good one. But what we found out is there's some support to get people out. There's almost no support once people are out. So I stopped reading celebrity magazines. I'm no longer interested in, you know, Jennifer Aniston's hair. And I am, my celebrities who I just sort of always look up to, I get my life lessons from, are people like Christine Bunch. So we're going to, instead of making Christine go through an exhaustive telling of her story, I'm going to have you guys, we're going to watch a video, and then we're going to bring Christine out and ask her some questions, and then we'll open it up for you guys.
In a matter of minutes, Christine Bunch lost everything.
I ran out screaming for help.
She lost her child, her home, and then her own freedom.
You don't think it's ever going to happen. You think those things happen to other people, not you.
It was 1995, and Christine was 21 years old. In the early morning hours, a strange smell. The home where she lived with her 3-year-old son, Tony, was on fire.
I woke up. I was able to try to piece together what was happening. It was foggy. It didn't register what it was.
By the time she realized, the room was filled with smoke. A wall of flame stood between her and her child.
I tried to get in the doorway. I couldn't. I took a tricycle and broke out a window and tried to climb in and get my child.
Despite her frantic cries, Christine could not save him.
Every day since it happened, I wake up and ask why it wasn't me. Why didn't he make it?
Instead, she was left to cope with the unbearable pain of losing her child. And just when she believed her life could not get any worse, it became a living nightmare. Christine was charged and convicted of setting the fire that killed her son.
When the judge read my sentencing, I was given 60 years for murder.
Arson investigators concluded that on the day of the fire, she had spread accelerants, set several blazes, and blocked the door to her son's room.
And I'm never making it out alive. I'm gonna die in there.
She was only 22 and suddenly facing a lifetime behind bars. Christine adamantly denied setting the fire that killed her own son.
So, this is obviously tough stuff. It's a tough topic. But Christine is one of the most amazing people you're going to meet. And as you'll see, she's very willing and really wants to share this story with you, take questions from you about what it's like to get out and start over. So please welcome one of my celebrities, Christine Bunch. We're going to have Christine sit in a place of honor. Joanna, did you already introduce, has made this amazing blanket. So one exoneree to another. How's our mic? How's yours?
I think it's good. Can you hear me?
Can I ask you the question a lot of us are maybe dying?
I know what you want to ask, Laura.
What do you think I'm going to ask?
Yes, it is kind of like Orange is the New Black.
Now, isn't anyone else interested in that? Because frankly, okay, see, I am too. Okay, so is Orange is the New Black legit in any way, shape, or form, or in many ways, shapes, or form?
In many ways, depending on what prison you're in, there was sexual violence in the facility that I was in. There were women that got pregnant by officers. We did create families, and we did have relationships with each other or with officers because you're lonely in there. So that part is true. We did set people up and send them to lock because they did something to us, and we tried to say we were a non-violent facility, but a lot of traumatic things happened inside there.
And how you were given 60 years.
Yes.
And that was my question. Does that still hit you hard? And when you're backstage and you're listening to that video, we've been talking a lot about trauma today. We've talked about with Barb about how not to re-traumatize ourselves. And yet I know that you put yourself out there constantly to discuss it. So it's never going to get easier, is it?
It's never going to get easier. I'm never going to get over it. I'm never going to walk away and say that I'm unscarred, that I'm whole, or that I'm normal. But talking about it, educating people, letting them know that this can happen, lets me know that my 16 years with the son I gave birth to in prison, the grave that I couldn't visit, it was worth something. It still means something to someone else, and someone else is going to get to come home because I share that pain.
And so that's part of what you're doing now and what you want to do now is, and we've got a little time here so we can flesh back into some of the details and what happened and we can open it up. But what you want to do now, being completely outside of it, having been exonerated, but not from a state that offers any compensation, it seems like what you want to do is make those 16 years worth something so that you can keep contributing to the people you knew when they were in.
Yes. When I came out, it was extremely traumatic. I'd never held a cell phone. I didn't know how to pump gas because everything's handled at the pump now. And for some reason, we decided to get rid of self-service gas pumps. I don't know why we decided that. I wish somebody would have asked.
Certain states, if you're in Oregon, they only do self-service.
Maybe I need to move there. So, coming out, you're trying to readjust. I've got a 16-year-old son that I'm trying to get used to. And I'm in that same hometown where everybody knows me and everybody's pointing at me and everybody's whispering. And every time I saw a police officer, I thought they were going to take me back to jail. So I left and came to the one place that I felt comfortable. And just like this blanket I received and the big hug from Joanne, that's what it's like when you get with other exonerees. They know, they feel it, they see your pain behind the smile, and it's a hug the moment you walk in. And I would get that when I visited Chicago. And I would go to Chicago and hang out at the clinic that was partly responsible for bringing me out. And I felt safe there, and I could walk down the street and nobody knew who I was, and people said hi to me, and I wasn't afraid. So I left all of my family and friends and moved to Chicago on my own. I've been there for 2 years, and in that time, I work a full-time job at Northwestern University, and I consult on cases in my free time. I go to speaking engagements in my free time. and I continue to encourage others. So my plan now is my 2 years are up, and I feel strong, and I'm confident, and I know that I can make a difference, and the differences I've made in Chicago, I want to take back to my home state. So I am working on raising the funds so that I can go work at the Wrongful Conviction Clinic in Indianapolis. Right now it's a one-person show. She teaches full-time, and she's handling 4 cases, and that's all the staff she has. So I will be able to bring my network of people to assist her and oversee that operation so she doesn't have more to deal with, and hopefully lessen her load and bring more people home. We also don't have any policies. There is no compensation in Indiana. There is no evidence preservation in Indiana, and they are not videotaping interrogations. So it's a clean slate over there, and I want to see everything that's happening in Illinois happen in my home state so that this doesn't happen again.
So let's fill in some of the blanks for these guys now who've seen the video. We know you suffered the most devastating, arguably, I suppose, the most devastating loss anyone can suffer, losing your child. And freakishly then, you are accused of it. And even today, I've known you. You and I have had long discussions about these things. And I still had to ask you today, why did they think you would kill your kid? So
I'm still not really sure. They said they used a report against me that said accelerant had been found in my son's bedroom and that it had been found in the living room and the walkway. And so right after this happened, I'm in the hospital. I've just been told that my child is dead, because in my young mind, I didn't think that was going to be the case. I just kept asking, did you find him? It didn't occur to me that he wasn't going to make it. And the police were there 20 minutes after that explaining to me that somebody, either in my friends or my family, had tried to murder my child and myself. So every single support system I had, every person I depended on in that moment was a suspect in my mind. So they went through and told me everywhere that accelerant was found, and I couldn't wrap my mind around it. It had to be true. So then once I'm arrested, I'm still struggling, and you believe, you know, the truth is going to win out. You hear that all your life. You just tell the truth. You have this. That is so not true. I tell everyone today, if they're talking to you, get a lawyer. You don't know what they're doing. You don't know what they're going to pin on you, and you don't know how they're going to twist your circumstances. So
it's a kind of situation where they're convinced it's a crime.
Yes. And there was no telling them.
And then, so now we got to find who did it.
Right. So, thus, I'm the only person there. Everybody else in my family and friends checked out. They were at other places. It fell to me.
And we've seen this, I think, time and again. We've brought up a couple other exonerees that we know. And, well, Amanda Knox, one of the world's most famous exonerees. She was exonerated by the Italian Supreme Court a year ago, 2 days ago. So essentially a year ago, Amanda Knox was found innocent by the Italian Supreme Court. But everybody says, well, she was found innocent? Well, but didn't she do it? It is not a whodunit in her case. But very similarly to a lot of cases we see, they've decided, well, in her case, we know it's a crime. A woman was murdered. So they pin it on her, you, Amanda. You and your boyfriend, you guys did it. 15 days later, a guy's picked up going into Germany, and he confesses to it. So they bring him back to Italy, where he confesses to it again, to killing this woman. But they're too embarrassed, because they've already told the world that Amanda Knox did it. And is that something that we... it seems like it's something we see time and again, the reluctance of people to pivot and say, ooh, we must have had it wrong. Either it must not have been a crime, or maybe we had the wrong person. It seems like, is that...
That's exactly. With my case, there was a gallon gas can sitting on the porch. It barely had anything in it. It was for the lawnmower. It had a fingerprint on it that wasn't mine. So 2 days after my son's funeral, I'm arrested, I'm charged, and they're telling the judge, you know, the test results are going to come back and show that it was gasoline. I sat in county jail for almost 90 days, and the test results come back, and it was not gasoline.
So, phew.
Right. And at that point, I think, oh, they're going to change something because I was granted bond. OJ didn't get bond. I was out on $50,000. So I'm thinking it's going to go okay. So we plan, we're preparing. I really wasn't acting my best because you're trying to cope and you're doing anything not to think about the circumstances. And I discovered 2 months before I went to trial that I was pregnant. And that at the time was, I think, my saving grace. That was the blessing that got me through all those years. But I still walked in there thinking, you know, there was no gas. You've tested this fingerprint. I'm going to walk. And they submit a report from the ATF. And it said that 6 out of 10 samples tested positive for a heavy petroleum distillate. So that was either Jet A aviation fuel, like I'm going to walk into the airport and get that. number 1, fuel oil. I don't know where to purchase that, or kerosene. And I'd use kerosene lanterns, so it didn't make sense that I could throw a match on that and get it to light. So I thought, well, it's going to be okay. The previous owner had said, you know, in this area where you found 3 faint samples, that's kerosene. I spilt it when I remodeled the place. So I thought, we're good. You know, maybe he spilt more, maybe he tracked more. I'm going to walk out. And you did everything you could to pin a motive. You talked about the rock music I played at my son's funeral. You talked about what I was wearing, who I was friends with, the fact that I was just tired of being a mom, and you squeezed another witness to try to get her to say that, and that I was trying to give away my child. I mean, they came up with everything, and ultimately you had no motive. They asked about insurance. I'm 21. I don't have insurance on my car. I mean, you certainly don't think at that age anything's going to happen to you. It doesn't occur to you. You could walk out. So when I was convicted and sent to prison, I spent a whole lot of time thinking about those positive samples and doing that introspection of whether or not there was a monster inside of me, something that I couldn't face, something that I couldn't accept, something that had happened because it didn't make sense that there was something in his room. And for 2 years, I did counseling, I beat myself up, and I talked to people to find out if I was truly a monster. And then when we started fighting my case, and I eventually got a lawyer to take it on, Northwestern University came on to help. Schiff Hardin LLP of Chicago came on to help. And I told them we needed the original ATF file. I said, I don't know why we need it, but I think we need it. And so they put in the federal subpoena, got it, and discovered that in the original report, there were only 3 samples that tested positive for a faint trace of kerosene where it had been spilled. And there was nothing found in my son's bedroom or in the walkway. And I think that was the hardest part, realizing that somebody intentionally added those numbers to that report and stole my life and tortured me.
And now you do have a civil case where we're trying to unpiece all of that and who it might have been.
We do. And I know it's been reported that I'm suing for $17 million over and over again. I mean, the reality is most of these cases are dismissed.
Right.
People get nothing.
And so it's interesting because I think people see that Christine Bunch has sued for $17 million. Or we all have seen where people who were innocent and really traumatized are fortunate enough to receive some kind of settlement, $21 million or $2 million or $6 million. And I think what we all want to think is, oh, thank God. And I think what people think is, oh, she's suing for $17 million. Good, good. She'll probably get a lot. But the reality is,
I may get nothing.
A third or less of people who file civil suits who are innocent will recover just because, well, one of the issues is prosecutorial immunity, which we need, because if everybody who the prosecutors accuse of committing a crime and then they're wrong can turn around and sue them, that's all we would do was defend against one case after another. So we need prosecutorial immunity. I sense you saying, but.
I do agree with that, but it should not be hard for you to say, I'm wrong, I made a mistake.
If you have immunity, if you can't be sued and you can't have money taken from you, and you really can't even get disbarred at all.
Right.
So I've never heard it asked like that. So why can't you say, shoot, we made a mistake?
Exactly. And if we leave the immunity just with the prosecutors and somehow lift that and tell them, hey, if you got it wrong, just say, hey, I got it wrong. Have a compensation statute. Give me a little bit that I could have gotten a credit score, some renter's history, all those things I needed when I walked out that I didn't know I needed. And we go on our way. It doesn't have to be lawsuits and saying that our system is broken. There are ways we can fix it very easily. But for whatever reason, nobody wants to say, oh, okay, we see this report. I didn't know about it. My prosecutor said that. Maybe, you know, there's something to this, but we're not going to let her go. I don't care what that report says.
You know, Scott Turow, the famous novelist and very good lawyer, was the head of the Illinois Torture Commission that we convened after we realized in Illinois, whoa, we got a fair amount of people on death row who didn't do it. Cases kept getting overturned, and so our governor put a moratorium on death row and commissioned this inquiry. Let's look into why this is happening. Scott was the lead on that, and he wrote this amazing report, which I would encourage everyone to read, because he focuses on the phenomenon of tunnel vision. And we all do it. I'm as guilty as anybody else. Once I think you're innocent, I'm all about your innocence.
Right.
I don't actually want to pivot and say, oh, wait, now you're telling me. So I get it, right? We all do it. We decide, especially if you're a police officer, you're doing one of the hardest jobs that we have in our society. But it's almost like, according to this Scott Turow report, he's like, we all need to encourage each other to admit when we are wrong. And if we don't have such significant penalties of you're going to get trashed through the mud and you $20 million settlements.
Right. Mm-hmm. That would fix it.
Now, I know we mentioned your other son, and so to fill in that blank, you found yourself pregnant a couple months before your trial, somewhat your savior, but you're convicted, and I understand some states, including Nebraska, if you haven't been convicted of a violent, violent felony, sometimes your children are allowed to stay with you. How did that work for you? We talked about this earlier. If it's too much right now, can I summarize and go to the part where I want to ask you about social workers? In an effort at not re-traumatizing, you had mentioned to me that, so even if Indiana had been one of those states where they would allow you to keep your son or your child if you have a baby, you were convicted of a violent felony. So even if they had had that provision, that wouldn't have helped you. But you mentioned to me that a number of social workers and groups and churches brought the kids in or provided programming for them. And it sounded like it made a monumental difference to you. And so can you describe what that was like?
So Trent was 6 months old when the Family Preservation Program opened. It was a big room that we had gutted out in our rec center, and we had toys and we had couches and we had carpet in there, and there were snacks, and our kids were allowed to come in for one-on-one visits. That's huge, because in the visiting room, I could hold him. I couldn't feed him. I couldn't change his diaper. I wasn't allowed to get on the floor with him. That was actually the first grievance I wrote and won, because I wanted to get on the floor with my kid and be able to play blocks. So I got permission to go visit, because, of course, I have a violent crime. And it was funded solely by churches, social workers, different groups who came in, and they made sure we had a full-time staff person there to supervise. They donated a golf cart so our kids could be drove through the prison compound to the visiting center and back. They provided snacks for our visits, because some people live so far away they would take their whole 8 hours in one visit. So the kids were there all day, and our kitchen would provide food for them and make sure they got a nice visit with their mom, grandma, or auntie. But the special thing was Christmas, Halloween, Valentine's, they would come in and throw a party. So we were in there in our big gym with all of our kids. And as Trent got older, he turned 5, and he was able to come into summer camp. So that was a week-long camp. We shut down the prison, and all of us were out in the yard with our kids and our different programs, building maintenance, drafting. We made up little games and stuff for our kids to do with us, and we had lunch together, and we had a cookout. But the kids were able to talk and share, because when a parent dies, you're sad, but you can talk about it. And when there's a divorce, that's pretty normal. That happens. But when your parent's in prison, that's shameful. And you don't want to tell anybody, and you feel like you're the only one. So these programs offered our kids the opportunity to see there were others that were experiencing the same problems, the same issues. And they could connect, and they could talk honestly about, my mom's going to be here for 60 years, or my grandma has life. And they continued to stay in touch with each other. All of our kids on the last day of camp were given a packet with envelopes and stamps, and they had a notebook all week so they could take their friends' addresses, and they could keep in touch until the next party, the next camp. But they needed those bonds. They needed to be able to vent and talk about the shame.
No, I don't, and I think that's so incredible, because it strikes me that those people, the groups, the churches, the social workers, in providing that, you know, whether if their effort was to, let's help these women who are inside, they're by that, though, they're helping those kids, the families on the outside who are taking those kids. I mean, that's really spreads it.
Yes.
The effect is quite large.
If my mom got sick and couldn't bring Trent, and my brother, who worked 3 jobs to take care of my son and my mom and make sure he was there every week, couldn't bring him. Those church groups had a bus. And so they would make arrangements so that I could still see my child, because they knew how important that was.
So when, you know, for a lot of exonerees, you mentioned that, I want to ask you about after innocence and what it's been like for you. But I did want to, you know, touch on you mentioned going to therapy while you were in for a couple of years, struggling with, maybe I did do that. And I hear that from a lot of exonerees that, you know, if you're a sane person and all of a sudden everyone's pointing at you and saying, that girl with the peace sign, she did that. You know, that it's a strange, at some point you have to question your own sanity, because a lot of times family members stop believing you, stop coming. There's people in authority who are telling you you did something. There are all these efforts that are marshaled to show that you did it and to put you away and to keep you away. So you have to gut check yourself. What did it feel like for you when you were able to kind of free yourself of that?
I don't think personally in my situation that I ever completely freed myself. I still attend counseling. I still deal with PTSD. I still deal with survivor's guilt.
And the therapy that you got when you were in, do you know if it was sort of social? Was it based? Was it like MSWs? Do you know what kind of level of support?
Not initially. When I initially came in, my answers were so all over the place that he had diagnosed me as a narcissistic schizoid.
Oh.
And so I didn't know what that was, so I had to go look that up. And when he was fired because his credentials were faked,
That's right.
I went in to see the new guy and ask if his credentials were up, and he said yes. And I said, well, I've been told that I'm a narcissistic schizoid. And he said, based on what? And I said, well, those tests you just gave me. And he said, those tests say that you're fine. I don't know where that came from. He said, we'll get that removed. And so he talked to me because we were in long-termers support group because we were housed with people that had 90 days. So you're constantly watching people get to walk out to their family. And I'm sitting here with 60 years, and my roommate has life. She's never walking out. So it's hard, and it takes a toll on you, and you get close to people, and you watch them walk out, and you wonder if it'll ever be you.
You see a lot of people now who are out, right?
Yes, I do.
Like, you've mentioned to me a number of times your sister, and one time you sent me a poem, and then I ended up buying this book of poetry. What was that? Who was that for you?
So when I went into the prison, I'm 7 months pregnant, and when he was taken away the day after I had him, I needed somebody to take care of and somebody to look after. And so I met Donna, and Donna had been forced into a false confession. She was 14 years old in a maximum security facility. And so I watched out for her, and I made sure that nobody messed with her. And she was a typical teenager, very loud, very snotty. And so I got into a lot of altercations about her. But I encouraged her to sue the state. She did, and was placed into a juvenile facility until she turned 18. At that time, the juvenile facility said that my relationship with her was the most healthy relationship she had ever had. And so we were given permission from the superintendent to write and have phone calls every week. And that normally doesn't happen. She came back at 18. She got right into college and was on academic probation that first semester. So I made her go to rec with her books, every single rec. Nice. Until we got those grades up, and we graduated together, and she walked out, and I thought, you know, it's going to be one book. People buy one book of stamps, and when they use it up, they don't buy anymore. And that wasn't the case. I still had phone calls with her. I still heard from her, and as she went through a horrible marriage and gave birth to two beautiful girls, they came in.
Oh, really?
She connected with my family because my family knew how important it was that she have family because she had no one. And now she is part of my family, and those are my nieces. And when she got married a second time, he came into the prison to ask my permission.
Oh, that's amazing. You do have amazing relationships, and I love her book of poetry.
Thank you.
You mentioned she had a false confession. One of Christine's best friends and one of my clients, Juan Rivera, was accused of killing a little girl, and he was tried twice. The case got overturned. They tried him again. The third time it came back, they had conclusive DNA evidence. Was not Juan Rivera. And so they say to him, you know what, if you just plead guilty, we'll let you go. And he says, I'm not pleading guilty to doing this thing. All of a sudden, they walked into court with a pair of what they said was Juan's shoes. They said, you know what, Judge, we can solve this whole thing. This little girl's blood is on this guy's shoes. Look at it. Here you go. His attorneys are like, where did these shoes come from? We now know these shoes were not manufactured in the United States at the time of the murder. We also know the blood was taken from the autopsy, blood that was removed from this little girl. The police in this case quite literally took autopsy blood, put it on a pair of shoes that did not exist at the time in the United States at the time of the murder, put it on these shoes and walked them into court. So the jarring thing is false confessions are happening. It's interesting to me. Did you ever think about this before? You know, I never thought about false confessions except to think I would never do it, which is hilarious because I now know I would last like 45 minutes.
So, no. I mean, before this happened, I was a typical, if they said it on the news, you're guilty. Go away. Give them the death penalty. And then some of those very same people that I saw on the news and initially thought, you're guilty, when I came into the prison with them, I had a different opinion. I didn't know if they were truly guilty because I felt like I wasn't guilty and I was there. So that definitely opened things up, and I looked at people in a different way. But with the false confession, the plea agreement that goes on now, if they've got something to hold over you, if they have something that you want, they can break you. I would have broke. You had me in a room at 11 o'clock at night on the day that my son had died that very morning. I had just gotten out of the hospital. I'm barefoot because I have no clothes. And I have three of you screaming, telling me, you know, tell me where the insurance money is. Tell me why you did this. Tell me. I would have said anything to make that stop.
And but yet later, when they tried to force you to, you did get a plea offer, didn't you?
I did get a plea offer. When we did my post-conviction relief, the hard part was they had said that the doorway was blocked. In truth, there wasn't even a door on that door. So then they said, no, that a chair had been shoved into that door. So at my PCR hearing, the evidentiary hearing, they blew up a picture and showed that the chair was nowhere near the doorway. And my prosecutor was on his feet objecting and said, where did you get that photo? And Ron Safer turned around and held it up to him and said, it's your trial exhibit. I just blew it up. So
when they tried to take get you to take a plea, was it, we'll let you?
So the plea agreement would have been, you reduce my murder sentence to 40 years.
So this is, you're in at this point.
I'm in at this point. We are waiting on a decision. And it's a long process waiting on that decision. And so my main attorney, Jane Rayleigh, said they will reduce to 40 years. And once that happens, he will consider a sentence modification and you could be walking out in a year. This was 2010 and my out date was 2021.
Tempting.
Yeah. And so my lawyer said, we all know that you're a mom and you want to be out with your kid and we support you. And so I'm looking at her and I'm crying because I feel like they don't believe in me. They've given up. And I said, just tell me what to do. Tell me what I need to do. And she said, I can't. All I can do is tell you this is what they've offered. And so I put my head down. And I said, I want that. I want that more than anything. I want to be out with my kid. But I can't tell him that it's okay to lie to get what you want. And even though I want that more than anything, I will sit here for the rest of my time before I admit to doing something I didn't do. And so by this time, Jane's crying, and she hugs me, and she said, "We're going to fight. We're going to fight, and we're going to see this right." And they did.
Every time you tell me a story like that, or anybody, I think, I just so you know, you are not just out to help people who you might be able to get out, but you help everyday sort of people, because, so just so you know, when I get in tough spots and I like bubble up and get overwhelmed, I think, remember the other day Christine told me about that situation? Okay. You can clearly handle this. So thank you. And I know this is tough. So let me ask you a little bit lighter question and turn to you getting out, and then let's open it up for questions. What was your first meal that you had? What did you eat when you got out?
So they asked, and I still really have a problem making decisions. Because, I mean, we had one paper that I ordered off of for 16 years. So clearly I think ramen noodles, refried beans, and Mountain Dew are all you can get. So Ron Saver was like, "Where are we going to eat?" And I said, I really want seafood. And he said, "Okay." And we're in Columbus, Indiana. And so they didn't have anything really like that. He said, "What else besides seafood?" And I said, "I want colored food. I want to know it's real food, because everything's kind of gray and brown and you don't really know what it is and you're kind of guessing and smelling it." And so he said, "Okay." And so they took me to Bistro 310, and they did not have seafood on the menu, but when they heard that I was coming, they went out and bought scallops. And so I had scallops grilled with these cheesy grits to congratulate me home, and then they brought out platters of meats and vegetables and fruit, and we had champagne. And at this point, you know, Ron's told me, "You need to fly under the radar." Well, they're filming us drinking champagne. Is that okay? He's like, "It's okay. It's okay. I'm right here."
And you have amazed me, because most exonerees that I know, at Life After Innocence, one of the things we try to do is, like, do you have a phone? Can we help you with technology? You are constantly telling me what apps to get. And how did you get so good so fast? Because you can't use any, you can't use the internet when you're in. So there's no technology that you're using for 16 years.
So I had a teenager the moment I got out. Oh. So the very first night, my very first profile picture on Facebook is me right in front of that laptop going, "I don't know where the camera is." So I'm like, "Hey."
Oh, they're like,
and he was like, "That's good, that's good." And he puts it up, and I was like, "Oh my God, there's a password on this? I mean, how am I supposed to get in this?" He was like, "Just wait, people will start friending you." And they did. And so I'm talking to people that I haven't seen in years. And then he was like, "And you're going to need Messenger, because we need to stay in touch." And he said, "And if you're going to do videos," he said, "I would recommend, you know, something different than just regular Verizon apps." He said, "You need to download something specifically for videos." And he said, "And it would be nice if we had our own special messages." And so he told me what I needed. And as things change, I mean, we Messenger a lot. We have Glide downloaded now for videos, which is awesome. And so we try to stay in touch.
That is, I do think Facebook has been amazing. When we first started Life After Innocence 7 years ago, people were kind of using it, but it was almost tough to get exonerees to do it. It's amazing now, going on Life After Innocence and looking at our friends, and, you know, 50 people will be people that were innocent who were in jail, and everybody's like communicating, and it's, I mean, I think Facebook has and Twitter, and we can talk about how it's not great, but it's been so amazing for the world on so many levels, and I think that's one of them for exonerees.
Definitely. They were my lifeline when I got out. It was hard to cope. And they continue. They continue to.
And one thing that we came up today when we were talking, another thing we're seeing all the time at Life After Innocence is that my students, so we're a student-read run clinic at Loyola Law School, and if you are in Illinois and you're an exoneree, we basically say, all right, what's your number one thing you want to work on? A lot of exonerees, I have to remind my students that we have four people that we're working on now who were 15 and got out 20 years later. So they went in when they were 15, now they're 35. Do you sort of still feel like you're that age, that you get sort of frozen at that a little bit?
I went in at 22, and you stop. For whatever reason, you're not maturing. You're not realizing that, you know, prices are going up and that they're rating your credit now, or they're keeping a tally on your creditors. And so when you walk out, you're still here, 22. So I'm wanting to go rock concert. My kid said, we're going to see heavy metal. I'm like, I'm down. It was, I mean, hard, but I had him to push me out there and get me reconnected and make me connect with the world. Otherwise, I would have just hid. So, I mean, it's, I still don't feel like
never hid, just so you know, there's been no danger. Christina's been one of the most, every law student, as you can, you know, loves her. She's been so generous with her time and sharing her experiences. I want to say one last thing and give all of our hats off to Joanne and Christine and all of you guys who do the hard work to get people out of jail. Please support your innocence organizations. And I hope that more people start to, as we have it at Loyola, start to look at the after side, because you're witnessing, you know, right here in front of you, someone who's doing, I know she doesn't always, I mean, this person is excelling. She's the most amazing person on the planet. She said, I kept saying about her strength today, and she's kept saying, I don't know that I'm strong. Clearly she's strong. And not everyone has the grace and the strength, and so many more resources are needed to help people as they are walking out, to get their records cleared, to get innocence declarations where their states accept them, and then to just keep letting people know about it. The fact that you guys all have heard Christine's story and you'll carry it with you, and when someone says, oh, I don't know, but it sounds like most of those people get a lot of money, you can say, you know what? I heard this program. I saw this amazing woman speak. Just that we all let everybody know that this is a human system, and when humans come out, there is a whole other start to it. As we say at Life After Innocence, freedom is just the beginning. Thank you guys for your time, and thank you so much, Barbara.
You've been listening to a program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a conversation between Laura Caldwell, a law professor at the Loyola University Chicago School of Law, and founder and director of Loyola's Life After Innocence, and Christine Bunch, a woman who spent 17 years in prison for a crime she did not commit. In a program titled Life After Innocence, they talked about what happens next in the lives of wrongfully convicted and imprisoned people. This program, co-sponsored by the Nebraska Innocence Project, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 30th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.